Well, as you can tell, we've brought one of us in off the bench. So I'll introduce your new panel to you. To my right, Justice Bill Meyer. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel, and I'm Leanne Dofano. And we have three cases set for oral submission this afternoon. We don't usually hear cases on Wednesday afternoon, but y'all are special. So we are hearing your cases, and you're sandwiched in the middle. So we will definitely not leave before your argument's over. Okay. I understand both sides are ready. Is that true? Okay. Don, you're first?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
May it please the court. This dispute arose from the failure of a real estate development limited partnership. The partnership was formed in early 2008 at the very beginning of what we now call the Great Recession. The purpose was the development of a privately owned neurosurgery hospital in Fort Worth. And the project failed when the necessary financing could not be obtained during the economic downturn of 2008-2009. As the clerk has indicated, I represent four of the appellants. Mr. Krosno represents two. We've agreed to split our time 10 minutes and 5 minutes. I don't intend to address the historical factual background of the dispute. The case has been thoroughly briefed. The facts are thoroughly covered in the briefs. It's been argued once before. I would call the court's attention to tab 7 of the original appellate brief for a fairly detailed chronology that might be useful if there are issues related to the sequence of events. The trial was long and the record is extensive, but remarkably, the fact disagreements that relate to the specific issues on appeal are minimal. For example, no one disputes that the pertinent documents, which consisted of a partnership agreement, a contribution agreement, a lease agreement, and an option agreement, were willingly and voluntarily made by the parties, all parties represented by counsel, and signed with full knowledge of the contents. There's no claim in the case that the documents resulted from duress or deceit in connection with the execution of the documents. Also, no one disputes where the money came from to get into the partnership and where it went. The source of disagreement as it relates to the issues on appeal has purely to do with the application of Texas law to essentially uncontroverted facts. Before I discuss the specific reasons that I think the judgment should be reversed, I do want to make two somewhat global observations about this global observations about this case that I think make it unique in Texas jurisprudence. First, Dr. Cravens, the primary beneficiary of the judgment, claimed to have been personally defrauded in this deal, even though he contributed none of his personal wealth to the deal. Dr. Cravens did not put a penny into this this real estate development partnership. Second, Dr. Cravens comes away from the trial owning the partnership, owning the real estate that was the property that was transferred to the partnership, and owning a money judgment that is five times the total amount of all money put into the partnership from all sources. And it's that last observation that leads to what I think is one of the most crucial, if not the most crucial, issues, which is the issue of standing. We all know that the concept of standing is based on the idea that an individual plaintiff or an entity must be personally aggrieved in order to bring suit. Standing is essential to the court's exercise of subject matter jurisdiction. The facts here are undisputed. The real estate that was transferred into the development partnership, which consisted of a land and a medical office building on Summit Avenue, belonged to an entity called Wilmar Investments Limited. Dr. Cravens controlled that entity as the general partner, but he did not own the land. Any claim for loss attributable to that land belonged to Wilmar, not to Dr. Cravens. The cash that went into the partnership came from two sources. First was an interim loan that was secured by a mortgage against the property. It was a partnership debt, and any claim for waste or misuse of the funds that derived from the interim loan belongs to the partnership, not to Dr. Cravens, who was a limited partner. Finally, there were lease payments made for use of the existing medical facilities. Those were made under the lease agreement by CNDH, the existing association in which Dr. Cravens was a member but did not own. Any claim for misuse or fraud in connection with those lease payments belonged to CNDH. The standing problem in this case results from one thing and one thing only. Dr. Cravens chose to play fast and loose with core legal principles. The law recognizes the separate identities of individuals and entities that are properly formed and respects those separate identities. Dr. Cravens does not. Dr. Cravens at the trial repeatedly referred to the Wilmar property as his property, though it was not. It belonged to a partnership. Dr. Cravens repeatedly referred to partnership funds as his funds, though they were not. And he repeatedly referred to the CNDH lease payments as his money. And in this appeal, Dr. Cravens asked this court to take exactly the same attitude today as he took at trial. He asked the court to simply ignore the separateness of the various individuals and entities. He claims that the entities are indistinguishable from him, but that is not true. And there is no legal basis for Dr. Cravens to suggest that these separate entities should be commingled with his personal identity, yet that is exactly what he did.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Maybe you can unconfuse me on this. Was Dr. Cravens personally liable on any of the loans?
No. Oh. Under the, he was not personally liable on the interim loan.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only loan that was created.
Right.
And partnership, that was a partnership debt.
Okay, so he wasn't, did he have any personal liability for anything?
No. Had the deal gone to fruition, he would have been asked to sign a guarantee agreement on a construction loan, but that the deal never got to that point. So he had no personal liability. In addition to suggesting that the...
Mr. Harmon, before you leave,
yes,
that,
Mr. Mayor.
The language that gave and was talked about in the briefs where Dr. Cravens had a right to acquire the real property at the end of the transaction?
Yes.
Wasn't that a personal interest?
it would not be a personal interest that would give standing for the purposes of the claims, the fraud claims that have been made.
But the time he was to get at the end of the transaction, if he exercised his option to purchase the land, would have been the land could have been purchased in his own personal name.
And under the option agreement, had the hospital been built, had the construction loan been obtained, had the hospital been built, there was an option subject to many conditions that allowed Dr. Cravens to acquire the facility at that time in the future.
It's the only place I found in the briefing and looking at everything where there was any personal interest on the part.
That gave him no immediate interest at the time the suit was filed in anything.
Okay.
In addition to just suggesting that the entities are indistinguishable from him, Dr. Cravens argued in his SIR reply that he's entitled to recover because he was a third-party beneficiary, supposedly, of the contribution agreement under which Wilmar contributed the property. That theory was never pled. It was never raised at trial. It does not apply because the trial was over the partnership agreement potential liabilities, and he was a party to the partnership agreement. And indeed, the third-party beneficiary concept is inapplicable in a fraud case. It would only be applicable in the case of a breach of contract claim. In the more recent supplemental brief, it's argued that this is a hyper-technical distinction, and that is no legal argument at all, that the separate identities is a hyper-technical legal distinction. I think I saw my light, so.
Your light's gone. Wade? We got one more.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Wade Crosno, and I represent two of the appellants, Richard Myers and Realty Capital Partners. I plan to focus my very limited time on the issues that are unique to my particular clients, and there are other issues that we share in common with the other defendants' appellants, and we'll rely on our briefing for those and on Mr. Herman's argument. The primary unique issue for my clients is the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the jury's finding in response to question number 7 that Mr. Myers had committed statutory fraud because he had actual awareness of the alleged falsity of representations made by others. That question was in turn predicated on an affirmative answer to question number 6, which was limited to false representations made by other defendants on or before February 15, 2008, when the partnership agreement and the other agreements were executed. There are two important undisputed facts for the purposes of this issue. One, it is undisputed that Mr. Myers did not meet or communicate with Dr. Cravens at all until more than a year after the agreements were executed, sometime in the spring of 2009. It is also undisputed that Mr. Myers and RCP were not parties to any the partnership agreement or any of the other agreements at issue. Now, the false representations alleged here are at least those that are prior to February 15, 2008, are alleged representations by Daryl Lake and Ryan McGuire about their experience on hospital projects and about their ability to obtain financing. And let me just briefly state here that we don't think there's any evidence to support those misrepresentations being made or being relied on. And I'll come back to that in a second. But for the purposes of the issue of my client's actual awareness of those representations, Dr. Craven's briefing identifies 5 exhibits, only 5, that he says show that there was actual awareness by Mr. Myers. He lists those in his brief as plaintiff's exhibits 3, 4, 6, 8, and 16. Four of those are emails, and one is a draft letter of intent. And I encourage the court to go look at those emails, because you can read them forwards, backwards, top to bottom, right to left, however you want to read them, and there's not any evidence in them that there were any misrepresentations made, or more importantly for this issue, that Mr. Myers was aware of any such representations. It's just not in there. And as for the draft letter of intent, if you look at that, it was a draft that was never signed. It said it was not legally binding on its face, and there was a subsequent letter of intent and partnership agreement that were contradicted the statement in the prior letter of intent about developer fees. So that cannot be the basis for a misrepresentation claim. Very briefly, on the issue about whether there was an actual actionable misrepresentation here, the statements about the ability to obtain financing in the future were statements about or of opinion about a future event. And if you look at the predicate question number 6, it required a misrepresentation of an existing or past fact. So that cannot be the basis for a misrepresentation claim. On the issue about alleged misrepresentations about experience developing or building hospitals, there was no reliance there, because Dr. Craven's assistant admitted that she and Dr. Craven's knew that RCC had never built a hospital before. And that's at 14 Reporters Record 119 through 23. There's also, on top of that, just the basic issue that the statute cannot apply here, Section 27.01, because there was not a transaction involving real estate. Again, my clients were not parties to any of these agreements. Dr. Cravens did not contribute the property to these agreements. And even beyond that, we've cited case law in our briefing that says the sale of a limited partnership interest involves personal property and not the sale of real property, even if the purpose of the partnership is to develop real property. And that's the Kitchell case and the Marshall case that we've cited out of the federal district courts. And so for all of those reasons, the statutory fraud cannot apply to us. And I see my time is up. I was going to address briefly the Texas Securities Act, but I can rely on my briefing on that, and unless the court has any questions.
Any questions? Any questions?
Thank you. And now, Paul.
May it please the court. I would like to make a couple of points right up front, if I may, because I think they're important and I don't want to run out of time and not get to make them. If you read the briefing of the appellants, you could easily come away with the impression that the important decisions made by the trial court in this case were made in the heat of battle, in the middle of a chaotic trial, in an atmosphere of confusion. And nothing could be further from the truth. Dr. Craven's standing was challenged by the appellants months before trial with a plea to the jurisdiction. The plaintiffs filed a response. Both sides filed briefing. The court held a full hearing. There was post-hearing briefing. And then the court, after consideration, made its ruling and denied the plea to the jurisdiction. Their objections to the testimony of our expert witnesses on lost profits and on proper development standards were raised in a motion to strike filed months before trial. We filed a response, briefing was filed by both sides, a full hearing was held, and there was post-hearing briefing, and then the court, after careful consideration, denied both motions to strike. Then the defendants filed a very comprehensive, traditional, and no evidence motion for summary judgment, months before trial, assailing every single cause of action asserted by Dr. Cravens and any of his co-plaintiffs. We filed a response, which unfortunately takes up over 5,000 pages in the clerk's record in this case. There was briefing, there was a hearing, and the court denied the motions for summary judgment in almost every respect. There were a few causes of action that were eliminated, but they're not important here. So I just want the court to keep that in mind as it is working through this case. because, again, if you read their briefing, there's a theme of chaos and confusion and snap decisions, and that is entirely not what happened. If I knew they had never built hospitals, I would not have signed an agreement with them, with language that I do agree with within that contract, but not when they don't tell me the truth about their stated abilities. Y'all have read my briefs. You know that that is obviously the core issue in our case, and it remains the core issue in our case. Mr. Herman starts by talking about the fact that this project was begun at the beginning of the Great Recession, and it turns out that it was. But it's not like everybody was ignorant at that time. I pointed out the first time we argued this case, there is testimony in the record from a lady named Donna Arp. It is in volume 8 of the reporter's record. It's only about 30 pages. At the relevant time, she was co-CEO of RCP, Realty Capital Partners, with Richard Myers, and was in communication with him constantly. During late 2007 and early 2008, she attended a Harvard Business School course on investments in real estate, and she testified that the top topic of conversation at that amongst all those professionals was that equity had pretty much dried up, debt financing was getting harder and harder to find, and deals were just grinding to a halt. She was co-CEO with Richard Myers at this time. If anybody should have seen the Great Recession and the credit crunch coming, and in fact it was already upon us, it's our position it was these expert real estate developers and expert financiers who did this for a living. The Mr. Herman claims that the facts are uncontroverted, and perhaps most of them are, but there is great, great sharp controversy over whether Daryl Lake, excuse me, and Ryan McGuire and Rory McGuire had made, on behalf of their individual companies and Mr. Myers, misrepresentations about their experience level. Whether Lake had developed hospitals before when he hadn't, whether Ryan McGuire had done engineering work inside hospitals. In fact, on the issue of whether Richard Myers had any awareness, I hate to jump ahead, but when Ryan McGuire, who worked for RCC, first came to Dr. Cravens and his assistant, and he said, I have experience developing three different hospitals, and that is why Richard Myers picked me to be on this development team, because of my prior hospital development experience. It was admitted during trial, and I have this in our briefs, that both Ryan McGuire and Daryl Lake admitted by Richard Myers that these guys had authority to make statements on behalf of these companies. And so it is our position that they were agents. No one disputed that they were agents. It didn't need to be submitted to the jury because there was no dispute about it. They were officers in the corporations. The theme continues that Dr. Cravens contributed nothing to the partnership. But again, it is our position that the court has to consider all of the documents together, not just the partnership agreement upon which the appellants focus with laser-like intensity. There was a proper contribution agreement. And as Justice Myers said, there was an option agreement. The ultimate aim of this whole transaction, complicated though it was and long-term though it was for Dr. Cravens to be able to exercise that option a little over a year after the new hospital was up and running, use his equity interest in the partnership as his down payment, and purchase that hospital. And he could purchase that, he could get financing to purchase it, because he would have then had over a year of operating numbers that he can go show a financial institution and show, we're making a profit, we're cash flowing, we can afford this debt service, we'd be a good loan. That was what Dr. Cravens was deprived of. The fact that the judgment is supposedly equal to four times Dr. Craven's investment in the property absolutely makes no difference in this appeal, because Dr. Craven's did not recover on out-of-pocket damages. Dr. Craven's recovered on benefit of the bargain damages, and it was the entire bargain that we say was taken into account by the jury based on the evidence introduced at trial, both on lost profits and on the value of the property contributed, that allowed them to come up with their damage figures. The personally aggrieved aspect of standing is only one of the five that are listed in the case relied upon by the appellants, the Nausler case. You have standing if you have sustained some direct injury as a result of the wrongful act of which you complain. Obviously he has. You have standing if you have a direct relationship between the alleged injury and the claim sought to be adjudicated. Again, mm-hmm. we have fraudulent inducement and injury by not being able to have the deal that was promised, personal stake, and that the challenged action has caused the plaintiff some injury in fact, economic or otherwise. We believe Dr. Cravens meets all four of those standing requirements. Again, when you consider the deal, the entire deal that he entered into, and all of the documents together as one single unified transaction.
Mr. Wineski, where does Dr. Cravens' signature appear on an individual basis in any of those documents?
It appears in an individual basis on the partnership agreement, in which I believe, and I can't swear to this, but I'm almost positive, provides for him to obtain financial benefits from partnership distributions during the life of it. It also appears on the option agreement, which is the one that would allow him to purchase that hospital in his own personal name at the conclusion of the entire deal.
So he was a limited partner, 98.8% or 97.8%.
Almost all.
And then he had this one aspect about a future prospect if and when there was ever a completed project.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. But I will point out that the Wilmar property, which Dr. Cravens did consistently refer to as his own, it was owned by Dr. Cravens personally for some period of years before he contributed into Wilmar and then caused Wilmar to contribute it into the partnership. So, and it was a family limited partnership for the benefit of himself and his four kids. And Dr. Cravens would have had personal liability, by the way, under that property contribution agreement, because it obligated him to contribute the property to the partnership. But I will say to you, had the defendants not misrepresented their abilities and misrepresented their financial strength and misrepresented the state of the economy, Dr. Cravens had a free out. If you look at that property contribution agreement, it is Exhibit 4, I believe, or Tab 4 to the Mr. Herman's brief, Section 4, Capital A. It says, among other things, that if the appellants cannot come up with at least a term sheet for a construction loan within 90 days after that agreement is signed, all Dr. Cravens has to do is give a written notice, it terminates the agreement, he walks, and the land never gets contributed. Now, there was a letter agreement that added an additional 60 days to that on the front end, told everything. But follow with me. The agreements were signed on February the 15th of 2008. The 60-day tolling period takes you to April the 15th. Another 90 days takes you to July the 15th. The property was not actually deeded into the partnership until October the 1st. Dr. Cravens had 2.5 months, had the true facts been told to him, both about the appellant's abilities and about the state of the economy, that, hey, it's getting worse and looks like it's going to keep worse before it gets better. And we're the professionals. We should know this.
Let me make sure I understood what you just said. You're saying under the property contribution agreement that Dr. Cravens would have been personally liable if the property that belonged to Wilmar had not been put into the partnership.
I don't know how Wilmar liability could be established, but let me withdraw that. And it would have been Wilmar's liability, I believe.
Okay.
But in any event, Dr. Cravens acting on behalf of Wilmar could have terminated that agreement if they had been straight with him. And the property would have stayed with Wilmar, we would have had no lawsuit, and none of the rest of this stuff. Mr. Krosno has challenged Richard Meyer's actual awareness of these fraudulent statements. Once again, when Ryan McGuire first came to Dr. Cravens and Kim Reed, he said, Richard Meyer's picked me for this project because of my development experience. And in addition, the evidence in this case shows that Richard Myers was intimately involved with this project from the beginning, from the very earliest letters of intent that were approved and sent. He's questioning details of the deal about cap rates and rents. Richard Myers was in it up to his eyeballs and was the one that orchestrated the rest of the whole deal, using Lake and McGuire as his agents. Mr. Krosno says he thinks there's no evidence of misrepresentation. I will leave that to the court in reviewing the record. The draft letter, two draft letters of intent, which were not signed, but which did say that development fees would not be paid until the construction loan funded. Dr. Cravens didn't sue for breach of letters of intent. Dr. Cravens sued for misrepresentations in those letters of intent that said development fees won't be collected until the construction loan funds.
Those were letters of intent, which would be an agreement to enter into an agreement, and they weren't signed.
That's correct. And that's why I say we did not sue, and we're not suing or claiming now that there was some breach of those non-binding letters of intent.
But how could the representations in those letters then form the basis of a later claim for fraud?
Because they're representations. They're saying to him, Dr. Cravens.
Factual representations that were fraudulent.
Excuse me?
They are factual representations that are fraudulent in the letters of intent.
I don't know what was in the minds of the appellants when those letters of intent were written, but they were statements that turned out to be materially false as the deal actually worked out, because they started collecting development fees the day that interim loan funded on October the 1st. Again, we've already dealt, or previously dealt with the fact that, yes, Kim Reed did testify that she knew RCC had never built hospitals. We've never claimed RCC represented that they had built hospitals. It's our contention that it was Darrell Lake and Ryan McGuire who represented that they had developed and built hospitals, and that's why they were working for this company that then was going to develop the hospital for Dr. Craven. And lastly, the contention that this is not a transaction involving real estate borders on the absurd. Real estate was at the heart of the transaction. Dr. Cravens caused Wilmar to pay with real estate for his partnership interest valued at $3.32 million. And Dr. Cravens had the ability, had the contractual ability, to purchase that real estate personally back on the back end. So transactions involving real estate were the heart of this. There's not a single case cited by appellants that has this fact situation. This is the first time that we've had real estate contributed in return or in consideration for, as the documents say, the partnership interest. And that, I believe I will stop there because my yellow light is on.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Your Honors, I may jump around a bit with a little bit of time I have left. I didn't get to all my topics. No one contends that this transaction did not involve real estate. We contend that Dr. Cravens was not entitled to recover under Texas Business and Commerce Code Section 27.01 for real estate fraud because he was not a party to a real estate contract or real estate transaction. He was not a party to the Wilmar contribution agreement. Indeed, Wilmar at one time was actually a party plaintiff in this case, and for reasons we don't know, Wilmar was non-suited, I'm sure at Dr. Craven's request. As Justice Meyer correctly noted, the letters of intent were non-binding and were not pertinent to a claim of fraud. That another thing to remember with respect to those is that the representations contained or supposedly contained in the letters of intent were disavowed expressly by the partnership agreement, in which Dr. Craven said he was not relying on any of those statements, that he was a sophisticated real estate investor, and that all prior discussions and negotiations were being merged into the partnership agreement. One must look to the partnership agreement to find a basis, if there were one, for a fraud claim. We plainly don't think that the events and representations that counsel has mentioned rise to the level of fraud for the reasons we've stated in our briefs, but that also misses the point. Even if there were fraud, Dr. Cravens has no standing to assert damages for the fraud because he is not personally aggrieved by the supposed events of fraud. That is the heart of the standing point. And because of that, this case cannot be reversed and remanded. This case has to be reversed and rendered because there is no cure for the lack of standing in this instance. A point that I did not get to in my earlier argument, we've talked about the Business and Commerce Code Section 2701, but there was a special issue submitted by Judge Suttereth that related to a theory of what we've called continuing fraud. And the effect of that special issue was to allow a multiplication or doubling of the potential damages. The theory was that Dr. Cravens was defrauded to enter into the partnership agreement and then was subsequently defrauded by misrepresentations that led him to transfer the Wilmar property. The damages awarded in those two were exactly identical. The injury claimed in those two theories was exactly identical. That is the reason Dr. Cravens wound up with an award that multiplies many times over all of the total contribution of value to the partnership. There was also an award for reliance damages of $1.548 million, as I recall, even though the evidence was Dr. Craven spent nothing in reliance on the supposed representations. And that number, ironically, matches his attorney's fees award. The jury gave him as reliance damages his attorney's fee award, which they then doubled up in the attorney's fees question. Now, counsel has said at the beginning of his argument that Judge Suttereth worked hard on this case. There were a lot of preliminary hearings, a lot of motions. Yes, that's true. Judge Suttereth did work hard on this case, as most trial judges do. But the fact that the trial judges and the lawyers worked hard does not insulate this judgment from being reversed where this court finds trial court error, and we submit that there is ample evidence of trial court error that we've presented in the briefs. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Otherwise, I think I'm done.
Mr. Herman, there was some briefing that related to attorney's fees and the denial of attorney's fees to one of the parties, defendant.
Yes, that would be Ryan McGuire.
Ryan McGuire.
Ryan McGuire had an indemnity under the.
And that's when you say the case should be rendered.
Maybe that was too broad a statement. I could certainly see. Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, if the court agrees with the indemnity argument, I think the judgment would be reversed, but there would be a judgment rendered in favor of Ryan McGuire under his indemnity agreement.
I didn't see evidence of the specific amount of attorney's fees that were incurred by Mr. McGuire in the record.
I believe it's there.
Segregated from the other aspects of his lawyer's work.
I believe that's there, but I can't say that I could
I'll
point
at it again.
The court directly to it.
Thank you.
Well, we appreciate your argument. We appreciate all your briefing. It's been very helpful. Thank you for answering our questions. Your case is submitted again. And we'll go give it another try. You're free to go about your business or